You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon and welcome to Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours, but now, at midday, it's time for Bums on Seats. For the next hour, we'll be running down the pick of the latest cinema releases and preparing ourselves for the delights of the imminent Cambridge Film Festival. My name is Mark Liversidge, and joining me on the show today are Jenny Colley.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
It's the time of year when festivals take over news headlines, with Venice now in full swing, Toronto starting next week, and our own Cambridge Festival less than 3 weeks away. So it's one last chance at the end of the summer to catch a blockbuster or two before they go into hibernation for another year. And this week's films are all loud, proud and shameless. The most shameless of all is the recent king of the blockbuster, Michael Bay, who's returning almost to his lower budget roots with the back-to-basics view of the American dream of pain and gain. Conversely, Neil Blomkamp has upped the ante from his debut District 9, as Matt Damon attempts to make his way to the space-based paradise of Elysium. But we've still got time for something smaller, with Amanda Seyfried taking on the role of possibly the most notorious adult film star of all time in Lovelace. And we continue our look forward to September's Cambridge Film Festival with an interview with David Cairns, co-director of Natan. And we also talk to Helen Simmons, formerly of the Watersbright Film Festival, as she prepares to produce an adaptation of a Rudyard Kipling short story, The Gate of the Hundred Sorrows. That's all to come, but we start the show as one of the 99%.
I need to get to Elysium.
Whoever has this has the power to override their whole system.
Hey, bring down the bone saw!
This ain't gonna kill me.
You can save everyone.
We're gonna break into the most heavily guarded place in the universe.
Oh, yeah. They will hunt you to the edge of the earth for this.
Director Neil Blomkamp first came to prominence before he'd even made a full-length feature. His collection of short films brought him to the attention of Peter Jackson, who admired his ability to wrangle impressive visuals and tense storylines from the faintest of budgets. Together they produced the remarkable District 9, an apartheid allegory with a catchy marketing campaign which blended seamless CGI effects with handheld camera work and made a virtue of its South African setting and unknown cast. 4 years on, a new release, Elysium, finds Blomkamp mining similar political territory, this time the us and them of wealth distribution, injected into an action-packed Hollywood blockbuster. Elysium stars Matt Damon as Max, a career thief who's attempting to knuckle down and graft his way out of the slums. The rich and powerful have deserted Earth completely, and now look down from the vast circular space station of Elysium. Here, Secretary of Defense Delacour, played by Jodie Foster, is not above using some unorthodox methods to keep the peace, and to keep those unsuitable for paradise firmly on Earth. When Max is exposed to a lethal dose of radiation at work, his only hope for survival is to make his way to cure all medical beds of the orbiting Elysium. But the route up is soon complicated by military secrets and the lethal attention of Delacour's earthbound agent Kruger, played by Chartel Copley. Jenny, Elysium tries to repeat the trick of District 9 by blending political commentary on everything from immigration to Obamacare with another hardcore action movie. But is it such a successful marriage this time?
I think it's a very interesting allegory, and it does broach some quite controversial topics, which are fascinating to think about as you come out of the movie. In terms of successfully blending those two, yes, it does. In terms of having an approachable, relatable central character, no, not so much. I found Max to be very boring, not remotely engaging, and it meant that I didn't have that kind of entrance into the film. I didn't engage with the film anything like as much as I did District 9. So I definitely found District 9 to be vastly more enjoyable. I thought Elysium was fundamentally quite boring, which was a shame because the action sequences were phenomenal. Some of the camera work was amazing. The CGI is fantastic. But I think it fell down at its core by not having a very, very strong, well-written central character.
Owen, is it sensible to try and get that balance between the political side and the action movie? Should it have focused on one or the other?
Well, normally, I think normally it would be fine. I felt that in this case, the world creation, particularly at the beginning of the film, was so good. I was so drawn into both worlds. To be fair, I thought he created two beautiful worlds, both of which were extraordinarily different, very successfully. But I almost lost interest a bit when it got action-y, for want of a better word. I think I would have liked to have spent more time in those two worlds than have got drawn into this out-and-out, or relatively out-and-out action movie as quickly as we did. I mean, to be fair, it's the second half of the film, really. But I do think there's a problem with the lead character being fairly inaccessible. He's not desperately likable. He's not unlikable. He's just a bit of a nothingy character. I thought the supporting cast was very good. I did spend the whole film thinking, have they seen the Tom Cruise film Oblivion? Because it's almost exactly the same film. I mean, right up until to the very ending of the film, which I won't spoil, but there's similarities all the way through. I do think the one thing I would say about Matt Damon's character in this is that he doesn't have the problem that Tom Cruise has of being just irreproachably out and out good all the time. Tom Cruise seems to be, I mean, I thought Tom Cruise was great in Oblivion, and I think it's a very good film, but I think it's quite an interesting film at least. But I think that Matt Damon is, for such a big Hollywood star, quite lucky in that he doesn't seem to have the same baggage. He is able to play what is a fairly anonymous character. I think in a way, I don't think the problem with his character is his playing of it so much as, like Jenny said, the sort of writing of it. I don't think it's a very good character, but I do think I like the way it doesn't have, you know, he's prepared to be a bit more grimy than some of the other big Hollywood stars would be. But I did feel all the way through the film that the world creation at the start was far superior to any of the action stuff that came later. Again, I agree, some of the action stuff is filmed brilliantly, but I just wasn't as interested in it as I was in, and there's some panning shots over the world, which obviously are hugely CGI, but they're just amazing. I mean, really beautiful, beautiful creation of worlds. And I really liked that, but I wasn't massively drawn into the second half, really.
Simon, if I can bring you in terms of the action side then, how do we feel that worked? I think it was generally accepted that District 9 worked very well in action terms. Is Elysium as successful?
No, not really. The action was one of the many, many things I had problems with in this film. Was mainly the excessive use of shaky cam during the action scenes. I'm sure I actually... Aiden doesn't normally bother me with films, and I can see why they do it, but a few times I was even actually closing my eyes because it was just making me nauseous, because it was so still elsewhere. It was like steady cam everywhere, and, well, like steady cam, you know, on rails. It was such, you know, fine shots. And then he just has the shaky mix up, and it wasn't even like mixing it in and out. It was just one or the other, and it really, really jarred the action scenes. I mean, overall, this film was such a disappointment after District 9. And I think the main problem with it was actually the writing of it. It was very two-dimensional. The allegories, you know, District 9 are subtle in comparison. They just hit you over the head so much with what they're trying to say, you know, trying to be clever, and it just wasn't subtle. It didn't, like, give you the idea and, you know, let you make your own mind and, you know, feed you information. It just, like, hit you over the head with a sledgehammer with it. It was... it looked like Neil Blomkamp's joining people like... Zack Snyder and, dare I say, Christopher Nolan, people who visually are fantastic and technically great directors, but shouldn't be allowed to write a story themselves, because Blomkamp wrote this by himself, whereas District 9 had someone else, and his next film has got someone else.
And it's exactly the same someone else's partner, Terry Tatchell, I believe they agreed that Terry would go off to work on Chappie, which is the next film, while Neil Blomkamp focused on Elysium.
He did this one by himself. All the problems can probably be brought down, you know, to the writing, really being quite poor in this, to be honest, and such, you know, had nice ideas, but such badly executed, especially also the accents as well. I couldn't understand a word Charlotte Copley was saying throughout all of it, and apparently Jodie Foster redubbed all of her lines for this, which really makes me think how bad was her accent in the first place that they went with this one, which I can see the intellectual idea of it, being a progression between Spanish and English and everything else and getting a mix, but it was just comical in this. It was, like I said, it's such a disappointment, that's all I can really say.
Did anyone else find the things like the accents getting in the way of their enjoyment?
I thought that the... to be honest, it didn't get in the way of my enjoyment. The people who I don't know, but the people who I believe were... I forget his name, but the ranger, sort of the South African Kruger. His accent is insane, but in a way is one of the more understandable, less problematic ones, because it's A, consistent, B, probably his real accent, and C, the character's kind of ludicrous and it works anyway. I mean, his accent is the broadest South African accent I've ever heard, and I actually genuinely quite enjoyed that. I think it is true what someone says, that some of the people who are clearly putting on accents, I don't know if it's called that, but putting on accents, they're not consistent. That's the other problem. Some of the accents, they fluctuate, and that is a bit of a problem, but the biggest thing I agree with what Simon said is the huge problem of the shaky cam. There's a scene on a bridge later on where there's some sort of spinning, there's a fight scene, and I mean, for quite a lot of that, I don't think it is possible. I mean, my eyesight might be failing, but I don't think it is possible to define what is on screen, because the blurring of the camera work, the movement of the characters, and presumably quite a lot of CGI going on as well, just makes it. I mean, it didn't bother me as such. I didn't have to close my eyes, but I can absolutely understand why you would want to. It might as well just be coloured blobs. I couldn't actually define one character from another. It's not a huge amount of time, so it doesn't really matter. But then the thing that's really frustrating is, while that's true, there's other action scenes which are amazing. I mean, Jenny was talking before the show about a scene where there's a sort of heist scene in the middle of the film, which some of the camera work and stuff in that is amazing, but it does just seem a bit of a mess to me. Really.
Jenny, in terms of the kind of films we're getting for summer blockbusters now, we seem to have come into two different types. We're either getting the big franchise sequels, the likes of Star Trek and Man of Steel, or almost the auteur theory, someone like Christopher Nolan, Guillermo del Toro, or in this case Neil Blomkamp, allowed to just run free with a big budget. Do we think maybe they're being allowed to run a little too free?
I don't think that's a new problem, to be honest with you. I think that's been around for years. I've been saying for a very long time, in conversations with friends, that I think take some of the money away from them and then they'll be forced to focus more on the really important things, like the writing. Make sure that's right before they start running into a movie with half-baked ideas that don't really work. I mean, I completely agree with everything Simon said. The problem with this movie is the writing, and that the characters are inaccessible. You don't really care about any of them, and that what it boils down to for me was this massive plot hole of that everybody is so focused on the medical care and no other problems are relevant to anybody. So they're all really trying to get to Elysium to use the med beds. Everyone's concerned about their health. The hospitals are inadequate. People are booted out because there's not enough space, not enough money, not enough ability to care. No other problems are apparent in this universe. So never mind the fact there's not enough jobs to go around, there's not enough food for people, their drinking water is dirty, an endless list of issues that people face when they're living in poverty. It's just, if we can get the medical care, everything will be fine. And you can't paint over like that. It's not, medical care isn't whitewash. It doesn't make everybody's lives perfect. Just because they're able to access medical beds in Elysium, it doesn't make their lives better. And I think, for me, that really was a massive issue while I was watching the film. And it relates to the end of the movie, which I walked out in, after the film ended. I don't want to make it sound like I walked out mid-movie. I just walked out in disbelief. I was like, really? That's how you're going to end this film? What? And I'd gone on my own, so I couldn't even complain to friends, which is what you do when you go see a movie that's just riddled with plot hole.
I don't know how much ready to spoilers, but they portray the ending as a happy ending and great, and they won and they got everything he did. And you think about it for 10 seconds and you realise it's possibly one of the worst things they could have done to the population of the world, and they're pretty much going to destroy the society they do have. But they don't think about that because it is such concentrated on a single issue that the world doesn't feel, although it looks great, it doesn't feel real because it's just two-dimensional with that single issue affecting everything.
Just one thing very quickly on that. There is a scene, it's not very late in the film, it's quite early on, where the reason that, like Toby said, Matt Damon's character has been irradiated and needs, and there's a scene where the sort of Spike, I think his name is, the sort of gang leader guy, says, because you've been irradiated, you're now ill, you'll be prepared to do this thing I need you to do, and no one else is prepared to do it. And I thought, well, with anyone with half a grasp of what this world is supposed to be like, there'd be people queuing up to do the thing he wants him to do. Mm. But because, like Jenny and Simon say, the only only focused on problem with this film is medical, illness. It's only when Matt Damon's character gets ill. I mean, I believe Matt Damon's character wouldn't have done this before he got ill, but there'd be like tens of thousands, if not millions, of people totally happy to queue up to do this thing without the particular motivation that Matt Damon has. All of the other people would have lots of their own, like you say, just poverty would be a pretty strong motivator for a lot of them. It is way too focused on that. And it's an example of this thing of hitting you over the head with one sort of single issue thing, which, it's a very legitimate problem for that world. But like Simon says, the world is undermined for all that it's beautiful by the fact that there's not, even Matt Damon's character's got a job. He's sort of all right. And it doesn't really show. It just shows people sort of standing about looking a bit downtrodden. It doesn't actually show you any of the consequences of, apart from, actually, it's not quite fair because in the daughter of one of the characters he's got the consequences of, but again, it's medical. It's too simple.
There is a lot beautiful about this film. A lot of the special effects are really lovely. And some of the camera work is quite shaky and bad. Some of the camera work is amazing. I mean, it sort of falls into two camps. There is a lot really very good about this film, and if someone were able to take Neil Blomkamp's script and pare it down and add some depth, it would have been a really great film. But the fact that the characters are so unapproachable, so two-dimensional, that was what let it down. I think for all of us, really, the writing just, it wasn't good enough.
I mean, I agree. Like I said, it was disappointing. The production design and the work by Weta, and making a living world appear, despite the social and the psychological problems we were mentioning, it is just absolutely an amazing work on that level, and that is what he does so well. But you need a grade A in all departments. You can't say it looks good. And everything else just lets it down.
And I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Elysium opened last week and is still showing at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas, and it's a Certificate 15. The press focus on next month's Cambridge Film Festival is, understandably, on the UK and world premieres, the new films and the new filmmakers. But Cambridge has always been an excellent festival for throwing valuable light on forgotten areas of filmmaking, from the corners of the world finding their filmmaking feet, and the nearly forgotten powers of cinema. On the 24th and 25th of September, the festival is screening Natan, a documentary from film writer and academic David Cairns and recent Grierson Award-winning documentarian Paul Duane. The film, a careful collage of interviews, archive footage and modern abstraction, is an attempt to piece together the tale of film producer Bernard Natan. A mysterious figure, whose Wikipedia entry is almost all hearsay and guesswork, Natan was a French movie mogul of the silent era, who brought the rundown Pathé studio and built it into the start of an innovative media empire before being brought down by rumours of his work in the pornographic film industry. Sent to prison for business fraud, he was unable to escape the German occupation and ended his life amongst the many murdered in Auschwitz. Toby Miller spoke to David Cairns over Skype from his home in Scotland about the mysterious life of Bernard Natan, the difficulty in tracking down archive footage of the period, finding interviewees, and how to make an evocative film on a budget. But he began by asking Mr. Cairns how Natan's extraordinary life had been all but rubbed from history.
Imagine a man has been murdered. The body has been burned. What's left? A name. A reputation. The sum total of everything written and said about him. This forms a kind of newsprint effigy, a shadow made of words. If he's lucky, the outline resembles the man, but distort the shape, and truth gets lost in the dark. The man dies a second death. Oblivion wins.
His accomplishments have been completely erased, and anything you'd find about him on the first couple of pages of a Google search when we started this film would be that he was a fraudster, a pornographer, that he had sex with a duck on camera, things that proved to be untrue. We were finding out all the time, okay, so this part of it is completely untrue. There seems to be no basis for this. This part of it is based on a tiny little misdeed early in his life. And in terms of the financial wrongdoing, it's tricky. Different people say different things, but there's certainly room for doubt. And he hasn't been given the benefit of the doubt at any point since 1938. If the film introduces the element of doubt into his life story, that would at least be an accomplishment, because we don't have enough information to condemn this man.
As you began researching, did your goals for the film change? You sort of didn't trust this angle that he was, by day he was a media mogul and by night he produced pornography. But did you have any idea of the scope of cinematic invention he was responsible for and the larger story of early 20th century prejudices and biases?
A lot of that we didn't know. We knew his ultimate fate. So we knew there was a tragedy in here, and we just didn't know what led to it, in a way. We certainly had no inkling of how important a figure he was, really, at that time. We hadn't seen the films, and we hadn't read the backstory and the various innovations that he made as head of Pathé, and how he basically pulled French cinema into the talking picture era, and how he developed CinemaScope, all of this stuff. So somehow this story, this criminal history had been attached to Bernard Natan, but how that happened still kind of had to be discovered. It was scary for me because I'd never made a documentary, so you're embarking on a film where you don't initially know what the story is, kind of like making a film without a script, if it were fiction. Fortunately, there was a story. There's a really good story there. I'm now incredibly excited that we got to tell this story. I'm too bashful to make enormous claims for the film, but I think the story that we're telling is incredible.
Was there a stage during production where you and Paul realized that you were actually making a film that the more you found out, was the more important it became as an academic resource? And was that something that you sort of balked at? It sort of made you approach it slightly differently? And maybe the approach that you've taken sort of undermines that sensibly in a way.
I think we were aware that there was going to be a shortage of visual material to illustrate this man's life. And we were going into it thinking that we would try to be experimental and creative and find solutions to that. And we were dealing with a story where there were a lot of lies that had been told, and the lies were part of the story. Even though we wanted to tell the truth, you couldn't tell the truth without addressing the fact, because it's part of the drama, that this is a man who's been trashed. So we had to find ways of illustrating things that were untrue. And so, yeah, the idea of bringing in an unreliable narrator or a film where we don't have a voice of authority, really. We just present different versions of what people have suggested happened and let the audience kind of work out for themselves the truth, or a version of the truth, or the best truth that we can come up with.
Which brings me on nicely to my next question. In the process, you sort of started with only slander and whispers and hearsays, and then you went from having not sure you had a story to having an amazing story or an important story. How did you decide what to take out, what to leave in, and why did you settle on from 3 hours to go down to a running time of 66 minutes?
Yeah, it's an odd thing to do, isn't it? When we piled together the basic interview stuff, that was 3 hours long, but all it was interviewees talking and repeating each other quite a bit. So then it was a question of hacking that down to get rid of all the repetition and make a clear run-through of the storyline, which it turned out had to be fairly chronological. There wasn't really any way of departing from that because it's such an unfamiliar story. You would confuse people if you stepped out of the running order of what really happened. The structure that we arrived at that made sense was a film just over an hour long, and so that's what we got. We're quite happy with how it turned out in terms of as clear a telling of this complicated story as could be hoped for, I think.
Watching a movie. I always loved movies. And now I am a movie.
How did you go about obtaining interviews for the film, and what sort of range do they cover? I know you had his granddaughters, I believe, and you also had Giselle Casadeas, who's at 98 years old, is the last surviving cast member from one of the Tarn's productions.
We started off with a couple of people who seem to know things about French cinema of this period. Lenny Borger is an expert on early French cinema, early 30s French cinema particularly. And through him, we got in touch with the granddaughters, who have been campaigning for a while to try and clear the grandfather's name. And they were quite eager to be involved in a project that would help to do that. And yeah, Giselle Casadesus, who's this amazing 98-year-old actress who made her screen debut in 1934 at the age of 20 in a Bernard Nathan production. She's so sharp and so funny and interesting. You couldn't ask for better. But yeah, I mean, it was a fairly small number of people that you could actually look to either know anything about the cinema of this period or to have any kind of personal connection to it.
What has been the response to your documentary in France?
Well, his granddaughters were very happy with the film, thank God. Some of the other participants in the film have been very complimentary. We will soon be announcing a major French film festival that we're very delighted to be screening in. So yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what the French response is. You know, two outsiders blundering into a French story in hopes of getting enough of it right that it won't be an embarrassment. It's going to be really interesting. I think it's accurate enough that any mistakes we've made can be overlooked because the story is important enough.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to David Cairns for fitting the interview in during a busy schedule of promoting the Tarn. He was just about to fly to America for the film's US premiere at the Telluride Festival. The Tarn is screening twice during the film festival, on September the 24th at 5 p.m. and then again at 1:30 on the 25th of September. You can find out more on page 25 of the new programme, now available to pick up from the Arts Picture House.
Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Got an event you'd like promoted? Email publicity@cambridge105.fm or visit the What's On page of our website, cambridge105.fm.
You're listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. This is Bums on Seats with me, Mark Liversidge, and regular reviewers Jenny Colley, Simon West and Owen Baker. Don't forget that today, 31st of August, is the day CamCon is in at the Junction in Cambridge. Alongside all the panels and discussions, there is also a rare chance to see some science fiction and fantasy films on the big screen at the next door Cineworld. If you dash right down there after this show, you may catch Labyrinth. Later today, they'll also be showing Grave of the Fireflies, Avengers Assemble, and Star Trek The Wrath of Khan. Check www.camcon.com for more details. Still to come on the show, we'll be reviewing the steroid-fueled ambition of Michael Bay's Pain and Gain, and looking at a contemporary adaptation of a Kipling short story. But before all that, we're very carefully talking blue movies.
Does she even know what she's auditioning for?
She's adorable, but we traffic in fantasy here. You know, more pizzazz.
I want to show you this movie we made.
Oh, are you actually doing that?
And action.
We're all going to win Oscars.
The pornographic film Deep Throat has become one of the most popular movies of all time.
I didn't even know who that was up there. It's certainly not my little girl.
I gotta go, Daddy. What is going on? It's Chuck, isn't it? It's a long way. I'm not doing any more porn. She's gonna make it. Ever.
How does it feel to be the poster girl for the sexual revolution?
To me, it's a movie. Like any other movie, only it has so many better things in it.
Like what?
Like me.
Here at Bums on Seats, we take our commitment to reviewing seriously. So when a film with a tricky subject, such as Lovelace, comes around, we're always prepared to do whatever is necessary in the name of research, even if it might be difficult viewing. And even on this occasion, if that means watching countless Amanda Seyfried films. Yes, even in time. For someone in danger of being pigeonholed after the success of high-profile but safe roles in films such as Mamma Mia and Les Miserables, and whose ventures into darker territory have met with limited success, it's easy to see why a more challenging role, such as Linda Lovelace, would appeal. Lovelace takes a look at a key period in Linda's life, from her first meeting with future husband Chuck Traynor, portrayed by Peter Sarsgaard, through to the events that saw her become one of the most famous names of all time in adult entertainment. Her starring role in Deep Throat saw her become a household name, much to the disgust of her overbearing parents, Sharon Stone and Robert Patrick. Events play out from differing perspectives, and while the initial telling seems to gloss over some of the seedier aspects of the adult entertainment industry, the second half of the film sees Linda recounting events again, this time to satisfy the needs of a lie detector test required by her publishers for her damning autobiography. Owen, Lovelace is an attempt to give an insight into the motivations of Linda at various moments in her life. But does it give us a genuine insight into Linda the person?
Yes, I think it does on some level. I think that the problem with this film, which there are several, but I think the main problem with this film is that, how, this may sound a bit harsh, but I don't think her story is very interesting. I think, and I don't know whether she's interesting, but she does, I don't think she comes across as very interesting in this. I think that the, of all the stuff surrounding her and the film she made and the furore afterwards, I think the phenomenon of that film, Deep Throat, is far more, you know, a film that the first adult film to have kind of any kind of mainstream success and grossing, like it says at the end of the film, $600 million or something. I think the fact that she got so little of that money is vaguely interesting, although utterly unsurprising. I mean, it's sort of shocking in the level of disparity, but the fact that there's disparity is not surprising. I think the phenomenon that that film was and the way it broke through into mainstream American culture and to some extent sort of Western world culture is in could be interesting. I don't think her story is very interesting. And it's a story we've seen 1,000 times since. It may be that this was the original and totally genuine example of that. You know, the idea of Linda Lovelace as this kind of completely innocent, manipulated and abused person, and the pretty unequivocally evil, although I hate that word, but evil kind of husband in Chuck Traynor, is, and from what I've read subsequently and before about her and her story, it seems like in this case, those characters being portrayed as so black and white might actually be genuine and real. I think possibly she was completely innocent and he was completely bad. If it was a fictional story, you would find it a bit unbelievable, that sense. But in this, so it might be that this is the original telling of that and the original version of that kind of story. But nonetheless, we don't learn anything new here. We don't really, to the extent we do learn anything about her, it's not of interest. She made, not an interesting film, but she made a film that was subsequently interesting, and the phenomenon around that was interesting, and it's faintly interesting how awful her situation was. But she's not, I don't really see there's a story to be told here. There sort of should be, given how extraordinary that the Deep Throat phenomenon and all that was. But this story just isn't very interesting. It's very well, or quite well made. It's a bit Instagrammy quite a lot of the way through, I found. There's some scenes on a beach, which is just, I found it infuriating, because it felt like someone had literally filmed it on an iPhone and just Instagrammed it. So there's a bit of that, and some of the 70s kind of cliche and the characters are a bit heavy-handed, but it kind of works. It's sort of 70s. It's nowhere near grimy enough, considering the extreme content. Some of the stuff that it's showing, not from a sexual point of view, but really from an abuse point of view, some of the stuff it's portraying is horrendous. And yet, it's all kind of glossed over. It's all a bit... It feels to me like it's wanting to have its cake and eating. It's wanting to be a sort of glossy 70s kind of melodramery sort of, wasn't the 70s great, and aren't these people sort of exciting? And then also tell you this fairly horrific, I mean, for all I've said, there's nothing original there, it's horrific. I mean, her life was awful, by it appears. And, I just, even the thugs in it are kind of, they're really lovely, and they get rescue from it. So I don't think they did. And then the only bit of her life that I would have found genuinely interesting, putting aside the phenomenon of the film, the bit I would have found interesting was the period, the 6 years, which is the bit they repeatedly skip over and say 6 years later. That 6 years, as she comes out of that horrible situation and ends up with a family and, having been to some extent rescued and to some extent rescuing herself, I'd have really liked to have known how that worked. I wasn't particularly interested. I mean, they get to show Amanda Seyfried doing, making a porn film. Well, congratulate. I didn't find it very interesting. It's fine. I didn't find it particularly offensive or anything like that, but it's a bit... She's great. I mean, she does play the character very well. She's very convincing. I think most of the characters are played pretty well, but I don't think the story stands up to being told. I think it's told perfectly well. I think the way they tell it by going back over it's quite interesting, but I just don't think it needs telling. It's not very interesting. That was my sort of feeling about it, really.
Simon, does it feel like a very safe adaptation of this story?
Yeah, I would say it was safe. That's actually one of the things that did surprise me about just how safe it was, despite all the build-up and controversy beforehand. It's, surprised nowadays it didn't even get away with a 15 rating or something. First of all, I'd just like to say you're really harsh in your build-up and introduction. Amanda Seyfried has been in some really good films, and she's shown quite a lot of talent and range so far. I mean, Chloe was fantastic, and ever since Veronica Mars, she's quite a good actress, an interesting actress, better than a lot of the ones out there.
If I was being slightly disingenuous in the build-up, I think it's because some of those roles, even as good as she's been, have struggled to get critical acclaim or popular reception.
Well, she's been choosing smaller films as well to try and expand her role, and they are, they are smaller films. And again, I thought she did an absolutely fantastic job in this film, as well as Sharon Stone, who's just unrecognisable and absolutely amazing. It wasn't until she came to the credits I actually realised that was Sharon Stone, and Robert Patrick, the father. As for the film, though, I liked it. I thought it was quite interesting, but it felt there was a lot missing. It did fill out a lot missing. It was a kind of Rashomon-style film where, it showed the happiness in the first half and then retell it in a completely different way in quite horrific beatings and that, which, like I said, Owen's mentioned. But from what I've seen as a story and everything before, they seem to have missed out a lot. There just seem to be a lot of holes in there which they don't cover. The documentary Inside Deep Throat is absolutely fascinating, and mentions about all the mob connections, how the film got made, the gangsters who got arrested for and, you know, charged with indecency about it, which they barely even mention in this film that any of that happens. The part Owen just brought up, exception about the nice bounce, nice gangster guy actually saving it, apparently did happen. And it was actually one of these mobsters who did actually stand in and say, hang on, you know, you need to get out or whatever. But it's interesting how, apart from the fact the way it told it, it didn't even come down. He didn't feel the, like you were being told the whole truth. There has been a lot of doubt brought on her autobiography as well, and a motive behind that in real life, due to pressures from the church and religious family and all of that, which seems to be very politically motivated, and that wasn't touched on here. So whereas everything isn't clean, it makes it very difficult to say what's true, and it's probably a mix of everything and nothing kind of thing. You don't know, you can't come out of here thinking you actually know the story. You don't, like I said, it's, which kind of makes it a bit empty in the end, because you're looking for something interesting, you're looking to learn something about the person, and, you know, you may think you do coming out of the film, but if you actually look at the broader picture and actually more of the history behind it, you realise you don't, and it doesn't add anything to it, and it doesn't introduce anything that isn't already out there and been done better.
Fair enough, and I think we're going to have to leave that one there. Lovelace opened last week and is still screening at the Arts Picture House. This year's Watersprite International Student Film Festival, held back in February, was the last under the direction of Helen Simmons. Now, having graduated, Helen is using her experience helping to coordinate the festival by working on the production of an ambitious short film shooting in East Anglia. The Gate of the Hundred Sorrows is based on a short story written by Rudyard Kipling in 1884 and later included in his Plain Tales from the Hills collection. Originally a cautionary tale of one addict's decline in the opium dens of Calcutta, the story has been updated by writer Tom Moody and co-director Nick Morris to take place in an abandoned modern setting, with the poverty of the original replaced by a modern austerity. With filming only a few weeks away, Toby Miller sat down with Helen to talk about the group put together for the film, the risks of adopting a visually lush style for a film about addiction. But he began by asking if it was true that Kipling had always planned to have the story filmed.
Look, it's a body floating into the land. No, it's a body swimming out into the water. No, it's the land itself here that's a body.
There were plans for him, I think it was around 1922, to turn it into a short film. And there's letters that have been left and, you know, different bits of writing where he had planned to turn it into a short film. And for some reason that, you know, is unknown to us, it just never happened. The original story is based in Calcutta. And the story centres on a man called Adam who finds himself at this opium den. And I guess the central theme in my eyes of the film is kind of this apathy that develops through addiction and a stage of his life where nothing much seems to matter. And we just thought that there were kind of parts of it that stood out and made sense now, where there's uncertainty, financial difficulty, kind of nothing's that certain. I guess that's part of why he becomes so apathetic. So we decided, not only was it kind of, it could be visually beautiful, but we could change the story and make Adam somebody that, you know, was British and young.
It's only a few months since you stepped down the natural progression of Watersprite directors and moved on. When did this idea, this film, hove into view? And did it seem like a natural progression from the festival?
Yeah, I think it did, because, well, we started discussing the idea at the end of the final term. And I guess that's, you know, that was after Watersprite. That was when you're thinking about graduating and what you're going to do next. And film production has always been the goal. Tri-Hub Productions is the company that our DOP and line producer have set up together. And we've got Tom, our writer, who's come on board. So we knew each other at Cambridge, all of us. Georgia, another co-producer from Cambridge, and did lots of Watersprite. We've got Bethany coming in as first AD. And then we've got some other people who have found out about the project through Kickstarter and got involved that way. But I guess we've all got the aim of working in some area of film.
The mood boards and the and the production design work that you mentioned earlier all falls back a little bit on the visuals of the opium den, which, as unpleasant as they are, have a visual cadence, which is interesting.
I think what we're trying to do is kind of get across the point that whilst Adam is, he's as apathetic as they get, but when you kind of have that interpretation of life and that sense of existence, certain things actually become more beautiful. And there's an appreciation. It's almost as if time stops occasionally and you notice things that you may not notice before, and things are much more vivid and much more present. And I suppose that's what we're trying to get across in the visuals. There are drugs in the film, but it's not a drug film, and it's not Trainspotting, and we're not going for that or trying to replicate that, but we're just trying to tell this story in an original way, I guess.
That's a delicate line to tread, and it's very easy to suddenly topple over into indulgence. And this is an awkward subject to be indulgent on. Especially, to be frank, for a lot of graduates from various Cambridge universities. Are you aware of that? Is it something you're constantly going to have to keep an eye on? Whilst at the same time, obviously, you've got to be true into what you're setting out to do.
It's a topic of conversation that occurs almost every meeting, and where we draw the line and how we feel we want to appear. And I, in particular, am aware of that because I'm dealing with most of the marketing side of things. And, you know, when you're talking about a project, you step outside it a bit more and you realise, okay, maybe that is too much, and how are we going to appear? Because, like you say, I mean, there's the Cambridge graduate thing, and, you know, we're very aware of that.
Where are you looking to film it? Again, you're replacing the location of Calcutta with something more local to Cambridge, or at least this area of East Anglia. What are you looking for? It's a personal story, but it's a fairly epic canvas, the original one, at least.
We're actually looking into... We have a few potential locations that are kind of more, I guess, like country manor-type places, so quite grand but very, very English. We're still going to give them a kind of Asian edge with the decor of some of the den in particular. But it's that feeling of an aged place, you know, a place that's kind of just been left as a relic.
A body of land. It's the water itself. It's the body of water.
What's the distribution plans? Because again, I know that's leaping a few rungs ahead, but that's an area that you know a great deal about through Water Sprite, and that's part of the process that a lot of filmmakers forget about.
Obviously that's crucial because, you know, we could make this this film and everything be great and then just have it sit there. So we're definitely focusing on sending the film to as many film festivals as we can. So, you know, the big festivals that have their short film section and then ones that specifically, you know, focused on short films. And obviously through Running Water Sprite I got to know a great deal of festivals because we partner with them or because, you know, we just research them. So hopefully we'll make it to some shortlist somewhere. But yeah, that's the aim, to try and get it. We're going to have a screening and hopefully maybe screen it at Water Sprite, or, you know, we're just going to try and get it out there.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Thanks to Helen Simmons for coming into Cambridge for the interview. Filming on the Gate of the Hundred Sorrows begins at the start of November, and much more information may be found on the film's successful Kickstarter page or by following the production company Tryhard Productions on Twitter at @tryhardcreative. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 with me, Mark Liversidge, alongside regular reviewers Jenny Colley, Simon West and Owen Baker. As always, we're just the start of the Cambridge 105 afternoon. After us comes an hour of Saturday lunch, followed at 2 p.m. by Simon Burton's Arts Roundup, which today brings more Cambridge Film Festival news with an interview with Emily Baldy, who discusses this year's ridiculously crowded schedule. Having made his name with the most explosive excesses of Hollywood blockbusters, it's surprising to find director Michael Bay responsible for the relatively modest Pain and Gain, a crime thriller where the most outrageous special effects are its muscle-bound leading men, Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Based on a ridiculous true story, Pain and Gain casts Wahlberg as Daniel Lugo, a fitness instructor bored of the box he believes life has unfairly placed him in. Craving so much more, he comes up with a foolproof scheme to fleece sleazy entrepreneur Tony Shalhoub, with the help of Anthony Mackie's steroid-abusing fitness freak and Johnson's born-again addict who has the social skills of a bull in a china shop, the three of them setting out to steal the American dream they think is owed them.
What did you do with your time, pal?
Up north.
Are you fixed for a job now?
You just can't kidnap a guy and take his things. That's so illegal.
Sure we can.
We
got through with this. Nobody gets hurt, right?
Oh, man. We snatch him.
There he is!
We grab him. Signs a few signatures. We give him a protein shake. You don't even know what happened. I watched a lot of movies, Paul. I know what I'm doing.
The Sun Gym Gang has successfully acquired every asset you had.
What happens now?
Now I go to work. You said no violence.
And I meant it when I said it, I swear to God.
I cannot kill.
Duly noted. Look, when this is over, we'll all go camping. All right?
Okay.
Simon, Pain and Gain is something completely different for Michael Bay. A dark comedy with the effects and explosions dialed down. But does Bay manage to pull it off?
Bay made a very well-made film here. I was really impressed with his direction, how he can... I mean, he's an auteur, but, you know, how he can actually direct and without all the big explosions and everything. And I thought he was fine. And the actors were fantastic as well. Dwayne Johnson especially, Mark Wahlberg, you know, rarely puts a foot wrong. It was really exciting. It was quite funny for parts of it. But there is one big problem with this film. And I think I'm going to let Jenny talk about that.
No, you can start. I'll chip in.
You'll chip in, yeah. Okay. The thing is, they say it's based on a true story. And it is loosely based on a true story. And that's what causes the problem. Because about a quarter of the way through the film, when all they start doing all the bad stuff and the kidnapping, and then suddenly realizing the torture against a businessman who hasn't done anything wrong to deserve anything, it leaves such a bad taste in your mouth. You just,
no,
it's
he
then
had
uncomfortable.
Money. That's what
he had
did
money,
wrong.
And that's it. Legitimately earned money.
Yes.
But apparently
damn
that's
him.
A bad thing, and it really makes it hard to enjoy the rest of the film, knowing this film is based on a group of, you know, absolutely psychotic idiots kidnapping, murdering and killing people. And after that, the dark comedy tone is really upsetting.
For me, looking at the kind of cast list Michael Bay had in Transformers with the likes of Frances McDormand and John Turturro, and now coming into this dark comedy material, it almost feels like Michael Bay is trying to be the Coen brothers. Is that a fair comment?
I think there... I don't really know what Michael Bay's trying to do. I've watched a lot of his films and I've never really known what he was trying to do,
Michael
to
Bay
be honest.
Is.
No, I think that's part of the problem. Like someone says, this is quite well made. The one thing I want to say just quickly before any criticism is that Dwayne, who I'm not going to refer to as Dwayne The Rock Johnson, because apparently he gets all grumpy about that now, but Dwayne Johnson...
He's not here, don't
no,
worry.
No, but he's big though, isn't he? So you never know. He is genuinely very, very enjoyable in this film. I think he acts a bit, which is a bit startling, but he's really good in it, and I really liked his character. And I think the reason I really liked his character, apart from him being good in it, is that he's moderately genuinely likable, and he's slightly affected by guilt and stuff like that, which you sort of think, well, you should be, you know. I know he still does all this bad stuff, and but it is absolutely true, there is a real fundamental problem with this film in that you do sit there going, well, I think I should feel sorrier for the guy who's being tortured than this film wants me to. I mean, I did feel sorry for him, but this film's kind of going, yeah, that's unfortunate, but these guys are really funny. And at times they are a bit funny. It's not as funny. It's nowhere, you know, for a dark comedy, it's nowhere near as funny as it thinks it is or
needs to be.
But it's just not... It's utterly without any kind of moral responsibility for the bloke who's having his hand burnt in a toaster. I mean, it's pretty horrendous, and Michael Bay clearly doesn't really care if he likes the other characters more.
So there's two views on the American Dream in the film. You've got the view of Wahlberg, Johnson and Mackie, and you've got the contrasting view of Ed Harris's character, who's brought in to investigate what happens to Tony Shalhoub, who seems to be embodying something completely different. Do either of those approaches truly get into understanding what the American Dream's all about?
I think nothing about this film was about understanding the American Dream. I think it's just about trying to be funny and failing because the source material isn't funny. You know, it's a horrendous story, and to try and turn that into something funny, to try and turn someone's real life suffering into something entertaining, is awful.
I mean, it's almost trying to justify their actions by giving a motive, apart from the fact they wanted money and they were quite prepared to kill and murder people to get money. I mean, that's
pretty much it. If you're going to take the side of the people committing these atrocious acts, which this film wants you to do, then they have to have something good about them. And I agree with what Owen was saying. The only person that's got any redeeming qualities, even a tiny bit, is Dwayne Johnson's character. And you really should dislike the guy that they're doing it to, which you don't. He hasn't done anything wrong. And it made it really difficult for me to find things about this film that I didn't find appalling. Because I agree with what has been said already. The acting was great. The casting's really interesting. There probably is a lot to like about this film. But I found the fact that they've used this source material in a comedic way just so utterly reprehensible that I couldn't like anything about the film ultimately, because it offended me. I'm done.
Okay, thanks for that, Jenny. And this thing,
I just want to say quickly that I think there's a really good example of his kind of moral ambiguity with it, in that there's a scene sort of two-thirds of the way through where Ed Harris's character is interviewing some people who work in the victim's sandwich shop, and there's a quick conversation where they basically say, well, the old guy was horrible, the guy who used to run the shop was horrible, and the new guy's really great, and the new guy's the criminal, Danny Lugo's character. And you're like, well, that's sort of fine. And I get that he's trying to suggest that the bloke's not very nice. But he then is effectively saying, the fact that he's not very nice justifies him being kidnapped, tortured, having all his possessions taken, and he's a bit of a whinger, isn't he? You know what I mean? It's like, well, all of that might be true in real life. He might be a deeply unpleasant person and they might all be lovely and just very misguided, but A, they're almost certainly not, and B, it doesn't justify that behaviour, and it does definitely seem like Michael Bay is saying, if I can get some laughs out of it and direct it in quite a cool flashy way, which he sort of does a bit, and if those people are a little bit ambiguous, like he's not a very nice victim, then it's all right, we don't need to worry about it.
I mean,
it. That'd be fine if it was a joke. Sort
we were
thing,
saying, if not. They changed it, if they didn't repeatedly tell you it was a true story, or say anything about it being based on a true story, and made the victim a known drug dealer and paedophile or something like that, and they could have gotten away with a really good dark comedy.
Yeah.
But the fact that they repeat, like I said, they say it repeatedly, this is a true story. And the fact that it is horrific and the way they've actually chosen to do it, it does make it reprehensible.
I think we could have talked about that one for hours from the sounds of it. Most of it probably not very positive, but that's all we have time for on the show this afternoon. The whole kit and caboodle will be available to listen again as a podcast in a few days. And remember that you can always keep track of our comings and goings by following us on Twitter and Facebook, where you can also find updates on the Competition Commission situation, or by contacting us on bumsonseats@cambridge105.fm. We'll be back on the 14th of September with a show that is all about love and monsters. Writer-director Richard Curtis makes goo goo eyes at time travel in his offbeat romantic comedy about time. Vin Diesel battles budgets and beasts in the third Riddick film. We've striking Italian drama in The Great Beauty, whilst Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck are the young lovers on the wrong side of the law in Ain't Them Body Saints. Plus, with the film festival less than a month away now, we'll be broadcasting the third of our previews, this time looking at the festival's programme of short films. To play out, we'll go back to Natarn and some of the soundtrack performed by Scottish group Seti the First, which may be located on Bandcamp. Stay tuned for Saturday lunch at 1 p.m. But from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.